This is the session on humankind and food, agriculture's progression. Last time we talked about some of the reasons why this particular topic is or should be of interest, as I feel, to all of us. I guess the first and foremost is that food is very interlinked with problems and challenges which confront humankind. Absolutely no question about that. Also, I find that personally that I have a desire to increase my awareness and understanding about food, where it's produced, and what the history of it is, and to share this with others. Thirdly, there is a real need to relate contemporary food production that we have today with wise, judicious, responsible use of our natural resources. And if we go farther, we maybe won't be talking about that so much today, but later in the next session or two, when we talk about world food problems, to consider our stewardship of our natural resources and how we can be involved in, quote, heal, unquote, the earth and some of the things that have happened already that are quite alarming. And what responsibilities do we really have? I indicated some of the readings that dwell quite heavily on that particular issue. And I don't feel that I have enough background to get into that too deeply. What my background is relates more to the physical and the biological constraints and possibilities which have to do with food production and agriculture. So last time we were talking about the Golden Age, which was really, has been described, there are several Golden Ages in time in relation to food and agriculture. The Golden Age, as described by some, was the period of time of the hunters and the gatherers when it's been shown from archaeological records and so forth that it was a long extended time, extending over way, way back when humankind just lived off the land in a very, as far as we can tell, a very non-destructive type of way. In other words, there was a blending of humankind with nature, and this just continued. I can't recall if some of you were here the other day, but for example, Professor Jack Harlan of University of Illinois, that wrote this book, Crops and Man, was interested in how much time they would have expended to go out and gather native wheats, for example. So he actually went in an area of what is present-day Turkey, where there are wild wheats growing. It's called einkorn, E-I-N-K-O-R-N, einkorn, fields of this that still are grown. And he actually went out and determine how long it would take for him to pick a bunch of this, to harvest it, and then shuck it out, and then how much wheat he would have that could be ground to be baked or whatever. And he was able in about 3.5 hours, as I recall, to gather 2 kilograms of wheat, which is about 5 pounds. And when he had threshed this out, he had 2.5 pounds of wheat. out of this native stands of wheat. And and it's also been done with some of the native corns. They've gone out and in some of those areas where they still exist and see how long it would take. They've also made estimates of how long it would take, how much you'd have to hunt, how many hours you might have to spend hunting to get an animal that you could kill to get meat. And so many archaeologists and others, historians, have concluded that, thank you, the hunters and gatherers generally got along quite well. They knew what they were doing. They had knowledge of the life cycle of plants. They knew eventually, if they didn't know in the beginning, that many of the plants had seeds, that the seeds would regrow into plants again. So there was a life cycle. They knew that other plants just spread vegetatively. They didn't need the seeds. And so they learned all these things. And so if you, as Professor Harlan and others have said, the big question is, what did they know and when did they know it? They finally concluded that, well, they knew a lot. They knew a great deal. They had rituals, they had religious types of things they did, and so on and so forth. So that was the Golden Age. It brought us up to this point. Then when was the shift made from this hunting and gathering over to cultivation? When did that occur? Now there's some interesting things. Before we consider that, we might go back and just say that the records indicate that fire was the use of fire in a beneficial way was in about 500,000 years BC, a 500,000 years BC before the Common Era. So that as these hunters and gatherers, or the hunters particularly, after they would kill an animal, they maybe realized that there was an added benefit from maybe heating or roasting some of this meat. And of course there's been a lot written about how they would have found this out. Was it by accident, or did they actually figure it out, or whatever? But nonetheless, fire was used. Another big thing that came along before agriculture arose was at about 30,000 BC, Neanderthal man came into the scene. And following that, they claim there was a big increase, a rather rapid increase in the types of weapons that were used for hunting. Fish hooks were maybe, that they could actually shape fish hooks from some type of thing rather than just using thorns from branches. So this was evolving, you see. Then about the year, well, we can't pin it down to year, I guess it would be thousands of years, but someplace around 11,000 BC, before the Common Era, 10,000, someplace in there, and this has been documented. It wasn't known at first. It was only a theory, but it's been quite well documented that there was some major shifts. The ice that covered down into the Near East, even, or Southern Europe, began to be retreating. There was a climate, quite a major climate change. And it's in that period that it seems that some major shifts and changes were going on, out of which arose agriculture and cultivation. And in other words, the climate became better. And I'm going to show you some slides later, but I have one slide that indicates, that just shows, it's sort of a sample of what might have happened with reindeer, for example. If reindeer followed the ice or lived at the edge of where ice and other types of conditions met, this one kind of indicates the reindeer, which is still a wild. It's not a domesticated animal yet. maybe never will be, but it is cultivated by man. I mean, they actually herd reindeer, but they're wild. We'll talk about that in a minute, the differences between this. So I have a slide that shows man and reindeer living in symbiotic relationship way back, and one of the factors that caused this to happen. So in other words, there were changes that went on as the climate changed and agriculture began to evolve. And if agriculture did arise then, in about 10,000 BC, the diet of the people was changing. And so and if you jump from 10,000 years BC or BCE before the Common Era up to 3,000, there's a 7,000 year span there. This, people say, was a really kind of another golden age of evolvement of agricultural things that could be done. Diets, populations increased, and so on and so forth. So when we then, if we're just thinking about years now, the exodus out of Egypt in biblical times was after this. This was 1500 BC. So you see that there was quite a bit of agriculture. There were a lot of hunting and gathering that went on way back. And then you had quite a bit of agriculture with some of the major crops and animals before the time of Christ. Because in the Bible it's just full of, not full, but there are many cases in the Bible that talk about the Garden of Eden and planting seeds and on and on and on. So that's it's rather interesting to think of this. And I pointed out the other day that if you take this period of time when the hunters and gatherers were on this earth, going way back, it was in proportion. It was maybe like something that long that this type of a society existed. And from agriculture on, 10,000 BC until the modern time, is just a little glitch in time compared to all this time that existed before. So some people have been quite critical. For example, here's an article that was appeared in Discovery Magazine, May of 1987. It's called "The Worst Mistake in the History of the Human Race." It's written by a medical, it teaches physiology at the UCLA Medical School. And what does he say is the worst mistake in the history of the human race? Well, agriculture. That's what he said. And in other words, here was this stable type of a thing that had gone on and on and on and on and on. And then all of a sudden, here you come in and you start agriculture. Now, the first thing I'd like to, any questions about that? In other words, that come to your mind. What I'd like to do is talk about some major crops and animals and when they would have come into the picture. And the term that's used is domestication. Now, domestication is when you go from a wild, so-called wild stage, to a cultivated stage or a domesticated stage. Just doesn't happen like that. And well, how does it happen? Well, from the reading I've done, it's a gradual thing. In fact, it could be a genetic shift if you consider the wild wheat, for example, to a tame wheat. You don't have to literally tame the wheat, so to speak. It's growing wild. But to get the wheat that you can count on year in, year out, there's a certain genetic shift that takes place. Now, what would happen in the case of an animal, if you take the dog, for example? What has to happen to dogs so that before that they're running wild and you can't tame them down until all of a sudden you can have dogs in your house and you have puppies and they don't run away? I mean, in other words, it's quite a complicated thing whether it's wild, whether it's domesticated, whether it's a wild thing that you cultivate. So this, all I'm saying is that this is a huge area. It's very interesting, very interesting. But what you can pin down, and when you're thinking about agriculture arising, is when did some of these things occur? And if we take about 10,000 BCE before the Common Era, and let's go 9,000, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, we're getting up closer and closer to time, and put animals over here. Then, one of the first ones to come on would be plants, domestication of plants before the animals. This is what's believed. So 10 or before, we have wheat coming in. And wheat has a very interesting type of a background. There have been a lot of papers and studies made about this because the way wheat can be tetraploid, polyploid, in other words, the numbers of chromosomes that occur in wheat, they double. The chromosome number doubles sometimes, and so there's a lot of argument about this. But the wheat that is grown, let's put that there at about 9. And barley wasn't too far behind. Someplace in here. Close enough for discussion. Now, it's interesting, I'll just kind of feed some of these things out to you as we go, because wheat has been shown to have been grown in some of the first agricultural societies, if you think of all these years. And then wheat phased out and barley came in. Now wheat is a superior grain from a lot of standpoints, making a bread, all everything else, than is barley. Why did that happen? Well, it's been postulated that barley can tolerate more salted up soil than wheat can. So as they irrigated the Tigris from the Tigris and Euphrates River and with irrigation you build up salts at the surface, it was likely that wheat wasn't very promising pretty soon, so then they went to barley. And then rye is not, oats comes in there later on, and rye. Well, rye was more of a northern crop. So those are some of the main ones. And as I recall, rice, in fact, I've got it, I can guess at these, but rice is more down in this area. We'll check it out on my sheet. Now, if you go over to animals, one of the first ones to come in was a dog to be domesticated. And it's believed that was around 10,000. Make sure I get these right. For the purpose of discussion, let's see, get that 10. Right. Okay, 10. And then the sheep, goat, I believe it's pig, cattle. I had these down. If I was studying for a test, I'd have these down. Real good, you know, in case I was going to be quizzed on this, I could have memorized them for sure. And cattle, about 6,000. And then the horse, down around 3 or 4. Yeah, horse, water buffalo, and chicken, right. Horse, water buffalo in Southeast Asia, and chicken. Okay, so we get the picture here that these are some of the major. If you think of the foods then that man would eat from animals, you've got them covered. Now dogs were eaten, by the way, and for many societies. So that we don't eliminate that. Sheep, goat, pig, cattle, horse, water buffalo, and I expect all of these have been eaten. I believe, I don't know if these water buffalo or not, but I suppose they do. And of course chicken. Now these came from a lot of different places. In fact, so that we can save our time, let me just kind of tell you. Dog believed to have risen in the Near East, in Israel, in what is Israel and Iraq, in that area. Sheep in the same general area of the world, the Near East. Goat, the same area. Pig in Turkey, although there were wild, there's still wild pigs or wild boars in some areas of the world. But the domestication of the pig was believed to be in this area. Cattle, likewise, in fact, Greece. So this was a little bit later. The area that became in the Greek Empire. Horse was in Turkestan. Water buffalo, this is Southeast Asia. And the chicken in China. And these were largely in either Egypt area or in the Near East. And rice was believed to, rice is down here, 4000 BC, I was right on that. And that would be in Thailand area or Southeast Asia. Corn, I didn't throw corn in here because I hadn't quite figured out where it goes. Corn arose in the Americas. And corn has a very varied type of background genetically as to where it comes from and how it arose. And so I haven't been able to pin that down exactly in this. So you can sort of get the picture then that when you think of, when you're reading the Bible and you start reading biblical history and the Exodus from Egypt, and that all of these, which gets down into this period of time, that all of these things that have been domesticated ahead of that and were available.
Didn't the Bible speak, when the brothers went down to get food from Asia? I think the Bible speaks of that as corn, but it was really wheat.
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I don't think that the...
No, corn was from the New
Corn world. Couldn't have maybe been over
no,
there. Our corn, or maize.
No.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yep.
Well, in England, the word corn is a generic term which covers wheat, barley, and rice.
Right. Oh, yeah.
If you use the word corn, you mean any of the grains.
Oh, that's new to me.
Oh, yeah. Maize is called, or you can call it. But, yeah, I mean, the stuff bought in the market, you would call it corn on the cob.
Mm-hmm.
If you use the word corn, you still mean generic grain.
Or maize.
Well, that's, as I point out, I think then that this domestication is a very interesting topic in itself. And as I say, I have a slide later that shows that, and the more I've read, the more I've found out that whether it's wild or whether it's cultivated or whether it's domesticated, these literally eons of time that we had, there are a lot of things that could have happened during that period. Now, the other thing I'd like to do is to ask you a question. Why, given this background of this evolving out here, why did that happen? Or it's happened, and so now going back and thinking about that, let's see if we can explore some ideas of why that happened. Why don't we, and I'll put it down on the board. Anybody want to start?
I wasn't here for your session on hunting and gathering, but my impression is that to do that, the families had to move around in a wider geographical area, and that agriculture and so on would allow them to stay in one place, which would make it easier for the young children and the other persons.
Okay.
Because travel would be higher.
Yeah, in other words, what you call a more sedentary or settled type of existence. Okay, now that's good. Let's put that here. Well, we put settling down, and we know what we're talking about down there. In other words, they aren't just nomadic.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't just going all over. Any other ideas, comments about this agriculture? Why did it happen? Why didn't they just go on hunting and gathering?
Maybe the populations got too great for that gathering subsistence to continue.
Okay. Sort of a population pressure. Any other thoughts?
Maybe as they learned to use iron, they could produce tools that maybe we could. Maybe they learned to make some tools to, you know, till the ground.
Okay. Let's put that in here with this one. Okay. Any others that you think of, you know, I mean, just if you let your mind, I didn't know this before I started thinking about and reading about this, that there could be, these were some of the obvious ones that I would say, you know. Well, let me go through some and these will come in a little bit. One of the first one that has been talked about is that maybe had agriculture as a divine gift. Okay, now under that, what they meant was that a lot of these civilizations had a goddess or something representing the goodness of the earth. In Egypt, it was Isis. In Greece, it evolved, Demeter. In the Roman culture, Ceres, C-E-R-E-S. Sort of a takeoff of, or serial, the word serial is a takeoff of the word series. In China, Shang Nung, Sha Nung or something. In other words, that's enough to just indicate that there was a worshipping of gods or goddesses within civilizations that had to do with, even if you went out to maybe pick wild wheat or whatever, that was just provided for you, and therefore you worship that. So, the thinking here is that this agriculture would have just evolved because it was a divine gift.
They had to learn plant propagation, wasn't they?
Pardon?
They had to learn plant propagation.
Yes, they did.
How to do it?
Yes, they did. That's what's a little bit of the puzzler is. Why did they? You said they had to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they did. If they were going to do agriculture,
they discovered it was more profitable to do it that way than just.
You think it's profitable? Mm-hmm. What do you mean by profitable?
Well, it's more readily available.
Okay.
If you grow it yourself.
Okay. Good. Okay. Now let me take another one. Because we didn't mention this one. This one didn't come up. Because all these are cool. Agriculture, sort of a, let's say, a necessity or a in religions. Here it's sort of a divine gift, but if you turn that around, here, this has to do with how did you give thanks to this goddess or whatever for this, what had been provided for you. And so out of that came sacrifice. See? Sacrifice. You someplace in there, in different civilizations, there was this element of making sacrifices. And Abraham was going to, wasn't it Abraham? Oh, Isaac. Jacob and Isaac, wasn't it? That the fire, the lamb appeared in the bush, he sacrificed rather than his son.
Abraham and Isaac.
Abraham and Isaac, okay. In other words, he was going to sacrifice his son. And then all of a sudden, you know, he looked over there and there was this sheep or a goat or that was caught in the bush. And which tested his faith. So this thinking here says that rather than sacrificing the king because we didn't like him, you know, or he didn't have a good, didn't run a good government, or my neighbor, because, you know, they were actually sacrificing other humans, apparently, and so here you could sacrifice a wild dog or sheep or goat or something else that you had. So that this in the process got them domesticated. They actually religion caused them to domesticate some of these things so they could sacrifice.
It might have been a start in that too, because
religious reasons they would have.
And it could have been also for a chance to feed the poor down here.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I mean, this could develop from that.
Yeah. So that was okay. So we, as a divine gift, a necessity in religious for religious reasons. Now, under this one, there's an interesting point. In other words, that if you think of it, how would a person know that a large, let's say a large animal, let's take a large, what we think of as cattle, running around wild in the woods. How would humankind know that this animal would be useful to us before you domesticated it? You would own, you know, in other words, you had to get it tamed down so you could do something with it.
Well, they got the mammoths that way by cooperating.
Tell me more about that.
Well, that's Gene Hall's book, and I mean, in the fact that they worked, had to work together because they had to have so many people in order to handle the mammoth and get a hold of it, and then even to work it up as to meat that could be used.
Okay. Yeah.
So it took a lot of cooperation.
That's right. That's right. So that so that to end up with an ox later on that was actually a castrated male at a cattle or an animal that would pull that would have yoke over its neck so it could pull a machine or a plowshare in the soil. Somehow or another, they reasoned this out, see, but that animal had to be domesticated before it happened. And so that this business of, that's why they say this, maybe in other words, they got them tamed down and they were using them for sacrifice, and then they began to explore some of these other reasons why they could do it. That's what the reasoning is here. The third one is really covers this domestication. This is what is sort of a crowding concept. In other words, the things became more crowded. You got more people and you just had to maybe by chance these seeds that were growing out in the field that you gathered, they just on some burial site when somebody was buried, they put seeds there to take that person to the next world, and then those seeds, because of the nutrients of the decaying thing, that they found out that these seeds grew better on that when there was some of the nutrients there. So this population pressure or the crowding was definitely a thing that drove from the thing from the hunter to the gatherer to the cultivator. Okay? Then there's another one that's really pretty interesting, and that is really as an agriculture, as a discovery. And this one is pretty hard to believe that. And this is, I believe, I have not read the source, but it's referred to the book by Michener. Some of you have read that? The book? James Mitcher's book, The Source?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, apparently in there, he talks about that there was the women of Ur, U-R, that they went down by the riverbank or something, and they almost, it was almost like a magical discovery. They were responsible for discovering some of these aspects of agriculture and plants and so forth. See, in other words, sort of a thinking that, you know, some person, someplace, somebody just discovered agriculture.
Could you give the women credit for it, but I don't believe it.
Yeah, I think it's a little...
You also have to find out the good plants and the bad plants, too. Some are poisonous.
Yes. Oh, yes. In fact, we talked about that a little bit the other day, that that there's a built-in bias. There's a bias built in about the agriculture is that these people before them weren't as intelligent as they are. In other words, it was quite a bias. But by studying Aborigines in Australia, which see, that's only been about 200 years since they found the Aborigines tribe in Australia, and they had no domesticated plants, no domesticated animals, and yes, they were getting along very well indeed. And how there were some tremendous blunders that some they told about, that some of the people came in there, they saw these people eating these seeds, and so they ate the seeds and got sick, and some of them died, and they thought, oh, well, they must have developed a resistance to these seeds. Well, I guess those people were almost laughing at them, because they found out later they'd detoxified seeds. They had boiled them or done something with them over a fire, and these sailors came in and they thought, gee, they're eating seeds, so let's, you know. In other words, rather than giving them credit for being, have learned that and gone on from there, they just assumed that they didn't know what they were doing. And that was actually been documented. So this agriculture is this discovery, it's sort of a eureka. Gee whiz, you know, look at, all of a sudden we can grow these plants. It's a little hard to understand, for me to believe that could have happened that way. I think it's a gradual thing. Okay, and then finally one, was just sort of, the agriculture was sort of an extension, and this maybe fits this, it was just as an extension, of the hunting gathering. In other words, it just sort of was a natural evolvement. In other words, as some of these things happened, it was just a natural evolvement that you would go to this agricultural type of a situation. I think that's the one I can buy the best.
Are you saying we go and pick wild mushrooms, is that right?
Pardon?
In the same way we go and pick wild mushrooms.
Yeah, right. And then the mushroom, you know, in fact, I suppose if you were going to pinpoint a date for the domestication, so to speak, of the mushroom, look, that's been a long... You'd have to go back and study all different cultures where they've been eating mushrooms, figure out when they did and when they didn't, and then those people have brought them in now and domesticated that. And wild rice, that's not related to the regular rice, that's, in a sense, that's been domesticated. It's both domesticated and wild, because the Native Americans, at least in the state of Minnesota, have the rights to harvest wild rice in their native ways. And at the same time, you've got exactly the same genus and species that's been domesticated and grown under culture, cultivated. So that the wild and the cultivated designations are not completely adequate. Well, anyhow, that's kind of I found that pretty interesting as I got to looking into this. That, you know, it just wasn't a straightforward type of, at least in the thinking of people, of what happened. Any questions about that?
Well, I think another thing, I think going with that too, you talk about it all of a sudden happened. No, it didn't. Let's just take in our own time, the steel plowshare. That, you know, when they first put the steel into the ground, well, they thought it would poison it, and people wouldn't accept it. And then, you know, it had to evolve into something that didn't
work. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly right. Well, what I'd like to do now, unless you have some questions, is to kind of move on, because there's a tremendous amount of things went on. Maybe sort of tracing, and given that this did happen, agriculture did evolve, that you had these plants domesticated, and then other things began to happen, and how good a job did they do with their farming or their agriculture? Well, the records show that there's some horrible mistakes have been made, horrible mistakes. And the one book, that a little pamphlet I'd like to read a couple passages out of this to you, because this is just filled. This is very interesting, because this man who wrote this has worked for the United States Soil Conservation Service and in the 1930s was made a two-year extensive trip in the Middle East to study what soil erosion had done in relation to these various cultures. So this is just full of civilization after civilization where it was shown that they didn't take care of their land very good. In other words, even though they irrigated the Tigris and the Euphrates river valleys, that these were loaded with silt. Maybe if you just visualize it, I haven't traveled that part of the world, but visualize that the higher land maybe been denuded of the forest, so the erosion coming down, filling the river, and then they were digging these canals in there as population pressure grew, and these would silt in. And he even states it in here that no wonder the people that had been taken captive by the Babylonians, the Israelites, were taken captive and brought to Babylonia, that they sat down by the rivers and cried. It's in the Bible. He said, yeah, because they that was their job going to be. They were captives. They were slaves that had to, prisoners that had to dig the silt out of these canals. They had constant crews just getting the silt out of these canals. And as you got more population, they took the water out further from the mainstream. And so it's been pretty well shown that this, you know, that whole system sort of crumpled down after a while. Now let me just read this to you, because this is only one of many. And he's talking about Babylon. At the ruins of mighty Babylon, and this is written back in the 1930s. This is one of the first, when I was in agricultural school in the late 40s, I was interested in some of this, and I got a hold of this bulletin. This bulletin's way out of print. You know, it's just, so I've hung on to this copy for a number of years. And it's called Conquest of the Land Through 7,000 Years. At the ruins of mighty Babylon, we pondered the ruins of Nebuchadnezzar's stables, adorned by animal figures in bas relief. We stood subdued as though at a funeral, as we recall how this great ruler of Babylon had boasted. That, this is what he said, that which no king before had done, I did. And then a skip. A wall like a mountain that cannot be moved, I builded. Great canals I dug and lined them with burnt brick laid in bitumen and brought abundant waters to all the people. I paved the streets of Babylon with stone from the mountains. Magnificent palaces and temples I have built. Huge cedars from Mount Lebanon I cut down. With radiant gold I overlaid them, and with jewels I adorned them. And later on, they're talking in here about how, in other words, it just denuded to get these cedars of Lebanon to rebuild the temples and so forth. And so obviously you had erosion. You had erosion and the silt got in streams. And so, I mean, if you look at it from strictly that standpoint, it was that certainly could have happened. Later in this same
same one here. I was just going to tell you that he goes through his book with Egypt, with China, with all these other countries, talking, and even though he traveled to the Middle East, he was talking about his earlier experiences in China. And here, you can't see the picture, but this is a picture, and I always think about that when I was teaching for years at Iowa State to agronomy students. This is a picture taken back in the early 1900s in the French countryside. And it says under the caption, "These French farmers are digging up the soil along the lower furrow of their field and loading it into a cart. It will be hauled uphill and spread along the upper edge. They do this job each winter to help compensate for the downhill movement of the soil by erosion." So unless you got some system which takes care of this, it's just going to happen. And in those ancient cultures, they had two or three things going on. Deforestation, and maybe they had other climate changes, and the siltation into these canal irrigation canals, plus that if they were, the water was coming and they were getting salting out. So all those things had something to do with the productivity of the place, plus the increase in the population, plus the social things about the rulers, you know, taking all the wealth. So there's no question about that. That has happened over time. Now, if you take agriculture on up, continuing on, so there were definitely mistakes that were made. You move up into the Grecian and the Roman empires, and their aqueducts, their irrigation systems, that all was an advancement in agricultural techniques. For example, the Romans, they claim, were the first ones that rotated crops, crop rotation, that the English, what they call the English ley, L-E-Y, principle that was promoted in England and Northern Europe, where you rotate crops around. You'd have, like, say, 6 years. In 6 years, you could plant corn or barley or whatever grain, and you grow that for 1 or 2 years, and then you seed it down to a perennial crop like a hay crop, and then it's in that 2 or 3 years, and you go back. So you have a crop rotation. That ancient principle, using lucerne or alfalfa in there to fix nitrogen, that was developed by the Romans. So there were a lot of good ideas that came out of over that time. But when you move on quickly through that, there was a long period of time that really agriculture was just more or less subsistence based. It didn't really take off and go anyplace. Although these ideas came in, they fed the populations. There were famines and so on and so forth, until sort of an agricultural revolution in the 19th and 20th century. Now that's skipping a heck of a lot of time and a lot of water under the bridge, so to speak. But there were a lot of famines. There were a lot of problems, and so forth. And you come into the Industrial Revolution, and I don't have time to read this, but maybe I will when I talk about world food. That some of these people in Ireland were just before the Irish potato famine in about 1848 and 1850. I mean, they didn't realize that this potato blight, leaf blight, or potato blight was just going to literally wipe them out. It just didn't, you know, it just boom. And that caused a tremendous migration of people into this country and elsewhere because of the potato leaf blight. And what are some other things that came in the industrial age? Chemistry, a knowledge of chemistry and genetics, the steam engine. 1840, Justice von Liebig in Germany, working with chemistry, began to realize that plants did take up different nutrients. You know, they pinpointed down the various nutrients. And he was the one that came up with what they call the law of the minimum. In other words, if you visualize a barrel with staves in the barrel, and each one of these let one stave represent nitrogen, one phosphorus, one potassium, one calcium, and all these different elements needed by plants to grow. And the amount that you have in the soil is equal to the height of the stave. Okay, so the lowest stave in that barrel is going to tell you how much water you can put in the barrel. That was what they called the law of the minimum. In other words, if nitrogen was limiting, it didn't matter how much phosphorus, how much potassium you had, nitrogen limited the plant growth. And what were those elements? Well, I still know them, just you never forget it. Because I learned it. The first course in agronomy when at the University of Wisconsin was what were those elements that were needed? Well, we used to remember them by the acronym C. Hopkins Cafe Mighty Good. It was C-H-O-P-K-N-S. Mighty Good was magnesium and Mighty Good. You know, M-G was for magnesium. So it was carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, on down the line, phosphorus, potassium, the chemical symbols, because that's one of the first things we had to know. And then then were the ones that came on, molybdenum, boron, some of these others, traces, just small traces that, you know, in the 50s, 1950, 1960, 1970, you know, found out how the plants just need little bits of this stuff. And most soils have them, but if you get in poor soils, they don't. So the plants need those if you're going to get the luxuriant growth. So that was out of the industrial revolution, knowledge of chemistry, genetics, and so on. Mendel in genetics, he found out that, you know, working with peas, the flower color of peas, by figuring out simple Mendelian genetics, he could figure out the inheritance of, you know, you can figure out why you get a purple blossom. Is it a homozygous or heterozygous characteristic, and is it a dominant or is it a recessive gene? It's just like baldness in man. You know, how do you pass that on to the next generation? Same thing, Mendelian genetics. And then Linnaeus of Sweden, he figured out a taxonomic system to classify all these things. All these plants into genus and species, so that people could, if you say pisum sativum, you know, around the world, people know what you're talking about. Garden peas or peas, that's what you're talking about. You talk about Metacago sativa, you're talking about alfalfa. It's called Luzerne in Europe, it's alfalfa. We know that. So there's communication has been helped. And in this book, the tables in here of all the different places where the various plants and animals arose, they're all by scientific name and common name and where they came from. It's very interesting to follow that. And then, of course, you had the origin of fertilizer industries and so forth. It came from Europe and on into modern agriculture. Now, I do believe we may have to, we have gone for just about 50 minutes. I think what I'd like to do is to maybe talk a little bit in the time we have. Let's take 5 minutes to just talk about some of these things, because I won't try to run the slides. I can show the slides when we come back again in another group. What I have on the slides, the first one, let me tell you what it is. In fact, you want to turn that on? Just show them that first slide, because I think it's really an interesting... now this is a painting from Scandinavia, and it's just fascinating, but it shows a man here moving reindeer, and you'd say, well, how could that, that's so, that's just ridiculous, you know, that this guy, look at one guy leading these reindeer, they all follow, you know, up through the mountains of snow and so forth. And so here, it's a wild animal, but he has domesticated them to the sense that he can herd them. And I showed that to, I have a fellow, very good friends of ours at Iowa State. He's a professor of animal science, and he's very interested in history of livestock. Well, he's just studied this stuff. He just
And I showed him this. The first thing he said was, "Walt, you know that?" He said he wouldn't have had to have a lead on this first one. He wouldn't have even had to have to get those reindeers to move. I said, "Why?" He said, "Well," he said, "because," he said, "man, because of a diet, would have some salt, sodium chloride, in your system. And reindeer would follow man just to get a trace of salt from the urine from the man." I said, "You're kidding." He said, "No, that's what he saw in that picture right away." He said, mm-hmm. He wouldn't have had to have a leash on him.
That's what they do in deer country and where I go, where we come from, you know, put out salt blocks.
Yeah.
That's for the deer.
But you see, it's to me, it just seems like it's such an interesting case of who's in charge, you know. I mean, the reindeers are following man or human, and is it domestication or is it just use? And so the idea of wild, tame, domestication, cultivation, it when you start thinking about it academically and scholarly, realize, you know, some of these definitions just fade away, and you have to be a little kind, you know, to say, well, that's wild, or this is not, and so on and so forth. One more.
Is there one stage in the game too where they load them on the ships and take them across the river? I've seen that on TV.
Oh, the reindeer.
Yeah.
Oh yes, there's quite a culture up in northern. Now, this is the only other one. This is by the same man who wrote this book, Harlan, because this illustrates the one with plants. And we won't try to go any farther than that then, because this has the word tame and wild and so forth. Let's just think of tame species of grass. Now, in ecology, we have what you call climax and subclimax vegetation. Climax vegetation in this part of the country would be that type of vegetation that would be here if humankind or man didn't mess around with it. Okay? Just let it happen. What would you end up with under this climate and situation?
Trees.
I don't know. Cedar? What?
Yeah, the trees.
Yeah, you'd have trees, you'd have the certain animals to go with. Okay, so that's climax. Now, subclimax. A lot of agriculture in the Midwest and across this country is based on a subclimax vegetation. So you take this happens to relate to grasses and legumes. Alfalfa and orchard grass and what's called cockfoot in Europe, those were brought from Europe into this country, and they're used extensively. They're not used as extensively as the wild, as the so-called grasses that were growing here. Okay, which are native or wild, they haven't been worked on. So those subclimax species were brought into Europe from Europe, and lo and behold, they do a better job. And why do they do a better job in modern agriculture? Harlan says because they thrive under disturbance, they withstand grazing and mowing, they respond to high fertility levels, they have effective means of propagation. They compete well under use, they establish readily in clean seed beds, and they tend to disappear when not used. So this is a case that they have been domesticated, and the man is, or humankind, is sort of necessary for them to go. In other words, if we went out here and planted some plants, a little plot of alfalfa here at Holden Village, and we got it to go, I don't know how many years it would hang around, but it maybe wouldn't. It something else would take over. So it's rather interesting. You start to think about a domestication of an animal. If you have a cat, you bring a cat up to Holden Village and it gets turned loose, would it live? Or has the cat been too domesticated? Would a dog, you know, a little Pekingese dog or something, you know, it wouldn't make it up here. Maybe so domestication, wild, tame, and it's a really interesting thing. So I guess my thinking is it kind of is continuing on. And when we get talking about alternative agriculture, subsistent or alternative agriculture,
what's actually happening is that the modern agriculture, we're beginning to go back and look at some of these things. Now we know some of the things about how what the nutrients are, da 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 da. We can go back and pick up some of these old ideas, whether it was crop rotations of the Romans or whether it was wilder species, and how does this fit into a sustainable alternative agriculture that we look forward to the future? Because sustainability, what does it mean? How long can it be? And what I'm going to do next time is talk about the, you know, that we really do depend, those crops that I put up on the board, wheat, rice, barley, I mean, and maize, they're very, very, very important in how where the food comes from in this world.